Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Yeah, so they tested him, and then the next minute he flipping lit up like a glowworm, and amazingly he kind of just got away with it. Incredible stuff. But anyway, let's get on with the podcast. Ross Tucker, welcome to another episode of the Science of Sport podcast. Back from another trip overseas, and we're going to get into why you were overseas, but it's not going to be the topic of our discussion today because there's quite a lot to get through today. There's some news we have to get through. There's the Tour de France, which is on at the moment, and for all of you who are participating in our fantasy league, I'm down in ninth position, even though I've had the last two winners across the line. But Mike,
have you picked a winner for a stage?
I've picked two winners. I've got Philipson twice, having picked both of them. But I think everybody's had
him. Are you
sure
you're doing it right?
I'm pretty sure I'm doing it right. Maybe I'm doing it wrong because I'm definitely down on my luck. I think I'm ninth place in the Fantasy League at the moment.
Because if for example, I go to yesterday's stage and yes. I look at Sherpa Dave, thanks for playing Sherpa Dave, I can see that Dave picked Philipson to win yesterday, yes. So he got the full house.
Yes.
If I go to your name, I've got to scroll down for this actually. Hang on.
Down. Maybe I have done it wrong, but down. I've got it.
And I go to yesterday's stage, I do not see a stage winner pick.
You know what I've done?
Yeah.
I've actually got to put something into the... on the day-by-day basis. Is that right? So it's not just working on your team. Okay. Well, for those of you playing our fantasy league on the Science of Sport, you'll be pleased to know that unfortunately I have not done it right and Ross has done it right, and that's why I haven't done as well as I should have done.
So you're in, there we go. In 18th place, Mike.
Yeah, that's not great. That's not great. If you want to join our fantasy league, check out the links. We'll put the links up on our... social media, actually, and you can join us if you're listening to this over the time of the Tour de France, and you can still join and be part of some of the action.
Can you still play?
I think you can still play. You can kind of join halfway through and see how you do. But we'll check that out and confirm it and put something up on our social media if you want to join us for that. I know Ross put something out last week, which is the reason why we got quite a few participants at the moment.
From the patrons.
It's always a bit of fun to be had, but... try and do it right. So, Ross, you're going to give me a bit of a tutorial after our podcast today to tell me how to do it. Anyway, so let's move on to the subjects that we're going to be moving on today. And the main subject of our discussion today is going to be something which I've asked Ross to do many, many times over the last couple of years when we've done this podcast. We never quite get round to it, but it's a talk that Ross gave, I think probably heard about 5 or 6 years ago, and I've asked him to do it again. It's a little bit literally about why we as humans are designed to run and the adaptations that we have that allow us to do that. And it's a very inspiring conversation. It's a very, it's a talk, and some of the facts that Ross talked about, almost 6-7 years ago, I still use in some of them, our conversations with people who come to me and say, I'm just not designed to run, because in reality, you are designed to run. But anyway, let's move on to some of the news first. And our first topic, if I look at my board over here, an interesting case. And it's quite unusual, this, because this is something that we talk about in men's sport a lot of the time. But for the first time, we've had a case of CTE. Now, you have to explain what CTE stands for. But it basically long-term brain trauma from sports, courtesy of a athlete who was playing Aussie rules football and died subsequently.
Yeah, I died last year in November, sadly, at the age of 28. Mm. A woman by the name of Heather Anderson was reported this week in The Guardian as being, and I'll read to the headline, the late Australian footballer Heather Anderson, first diagnosed case of CTE brain trauma in a female athlete. So the reason it's noteworthy is that she's a female athlete. It's not the first case of overall, of course. And if you listen to last week's podcast, you'll understand a little bit more. I'm not going to dive into the massive detail of it, but basically CTE is a condition that can only be identified after death because it's a neuropathological finding in the brain of a deceased person. And it stands for chronic, so the result of many accumulated, traumatic, sudden impacts, encephalopathy.
Yeah, so that I struggle with that word.
Basically, it means pathology in the brain, right?
Right.
So that's, and so this was, you could go back 7 decades, 70 odd years, and you'd find cases in boxes, which were back then described as punch drunk syndrome. It became a big thing in contact sports, ball sports. American football was the first about 15 years ago when a retired American footballer was identified to have had these pathological changes. Well, retired and deceased. Again, that's the important point here. And there'd never been a case in women, which is really interesting. Part of it, and a couple of you actually on Patreon, thank you very much to both Deborah Latouf and Joshua Stacey for bringing this one to my attention. I did see it. Of course, it did the rounds in rugby because we have the same challenges. But like Joshua asked, for instance, why is it the first case? I mean, surely there have been others. And near as far as I know.
That was my first question to you when you raised it.
And you know, we and again, we discussed this last week. I just returned beginning of last week from a trip to Boston where we went specifically to have a two-day conference where we invited the world experts on this condition, CTE, and other long-term health outcomes of rugby to present to us. And it was discussed by many of those that there is as yet no data on women. So coincidental, I suppose, that 1 week after that trip, this case has emerged. And I remember one of the speakers was a woman called Anne McKee, who's a pathologist in Boston, who was actually one of the first, one of the leaders in the space of doing these autopsies and runs, co-runs that brain bank in Boston that's gotten all those American footballers that I told you about last week. And we put to her, why are there no cases in women? And the simple answer is that because if the condition is caused in part by repeated head traumas, those folk in Boston are not seeing enough cases of women who are exposed to repeated head traumas because there's no American football for women. That's the simplest answer I can give you. To this point, there haven't been brain banks with the volume of brains that are going to be the case in the next 3 or 4 years. So this particular case was identified in Australia in a brain bank. And I would imagine now, because they play both rugby league, rugby union, less rugby union, and then Aussie rules football, which is what Heather Anderson was, they will start seeing many more of them. The reason I think it... So that's the simple version, is you just don't have females exposed to sport in the same way that males are.
Yeah, you kind of think of as contact sports being very male-dominated.
Yeah, and they have been. And that's... Yeah. Like 10 years ago, even women's rugby was half the size it is today. The Women's World Cup, which was, it was held last year, it was meant to be the year before, that thing doubles in volume every year and the quality is improving, the speed, the power of the players. So there are some questions and potential challenges, which may be opportunities for the women's game moving forward in that area. As more
What's interesting women are exposed about this particular case was obviously she was initially said to have committed suicide. So there is some questions about that. Do you know
So now the question will be
what caused it, in other words.
Yeah, and this is actually a story that, well, not this, but the pattern of a young suicide and CTE is common and maybe the most famous case has been.
So it's related.
Well, that's the argument that they make. You know, so Junior Seau was a very famous American football player, committed suicide, donated his brain to science, and it was found with CTE, pathological change. Aaron Hernandez was in jail for murder and then committed suicide, and he was found to have what was described by McKee, I think, or her group, and certainly the media, as one of the most severe cases of CTE ever documented. So the suicide link with CTE is definitely one that's been discussed before. And so the autopsy on this athlete probably went looking specifically for it because of that historical pattern.
This isn't like when we talk about things like this, everybody immediately thinks of people like Muhammad Ali, you know, where he's developed conditions and Parkinson's as a result of this. But the evidence is now showing that such things as suicide are now related to this condition. So it takes on a new level of importance because suddenly those things potentially become explained.
Yeah, well, I mean, so again, CTE is the post-death diagnosis. Mm. It's the autopsy diagnosis. What the clinicians have tried to do is to identify and describe a syndrome that can be identified in life.
Mm.
And that's called TES, which is traumatic encephalopathy syndrome. And its diagnostic criteria are somewhat of a moving target because they're still being developed and refined. And there is an argument among the academics who actually work in this area as to how well the diagnostic criteria work. Because in athletes who have CTE confirmed upon their death, did they present with the consistent pattern in life? And the answer is no, not always. So there's some papers by Grant Iverson who's challenged and questioned how well that screening looks. Because at one point it was TES was simply diagnosed as did you play contact sports where you would have exposure to repetitive head impacts, and did you show neurocognitive decline and behavior changes? And so they started looking for things like depression and anxiety, aggression, and cognitive decline. And if the answer is yes and you played sport, well, then you have this condition.
Right.
And some folks saying that's a little bit too liberal a diagnosis. There are other things that can cause depression and anxiety. And I alluded to this last week. You're a football player, rugby player, whatever it is. You're part of a unit. Mm. You're walking out every week. You're the center of attention. You're doing what you love. And then at 32, you're no longer doing it at all. There's no phase out. You're in or you're out.
But I suppose the control is the people that don't have the impact. Like you talk about footballers.
Right.
If it happening more in the contact sports, then you could potentially say that it's the contact rather than the lifestyle change in terms of...
So, first of all, love the thinking, because that's if we said 5 years ago we were going to make scientists of you. that's a very astute observation. So yes, exactly that. And so there are some studies that have found that, for instance, depression and anxiety and so on in retired athletes, football maybe not the best example because it's also got a CTE brain injury repetitive head impact thing because of hitting the ball, right?
Yeah,
so
okay, yeah.
but you're right, other sports that maybe don't involve as much impact is where you'd look, and that's somewhat equivocal. I mean, that the studies overall in the NFL show that they have as much or expected proportion of people with depression, anxiety, suicide is similar. It's not like they jump out when you look at a cohort of NFL players compared to the general population. Matched for certain things, but not, obviously not everything. So it's quite a complicated question to actually answer. But nevertheless, the simple answer then is that expose more women to the same risk factor, which is to say the repetitive head impacts, and we're going to see many more cases in women. And I think I would certainly expect that there will be many more cases as brain banks increase the size of, or the relative size of their women's brains populations, if you can call it that such a thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do think, and Anne McKee again in Boston presented to us back in 2011, I think it was, they published a study on the brains of 111 deceased football players. Now, those were all males because they're all American football players in the NFL or college. There's no women's equivalent, right? And of those 111 brains, 110 had this CTE neuropathological change. So that's like up in the 99% range. But the problem that they've got, and the whole world's brain banks have still got in this regard, is that they're only getting brains from the people who have developed symptoms or problems while alive and then donate the brain. So the true prevalence is not possible based on that study because it's a biased sample. Makes sense. It's like if you only get certain segments of the population, you can't extrapolate to the whole population.
Mm.
But Anne McKee in her presentation to us said that the estimate would be anything between 10 and 90%. So that's literally that wide. Okay?
Yeah.
It's not all, but it's not none. That's all you can say.
Yeah.
It's greater than zero, less than 100. When we asked her about it and we discussed it in the sort of Q&A discussion after her talk, she sort of landed initially in her presentation, she said maybe 80. Then it was changed to maybe 30. So again, it's very difficult to know. But there are other populations where repetitive head trauma is a possibility. And that's the military, for instance. There have been documented cases of soldiers as a consequence of repeated blasts who get CTE diagnosed after death. And there's certainly been women in that environment who've had it. Exposure, anyway. When I say it, I mean exposure.
Mm.
and we've never seen it there. So it does make me wonder whether it's absolutely understandable that there would be far fewer CTE cases currently among women because they just haven't had the opportunities to play the contact sports. But the fact that there is quite as low as they are also suggests that the prevalence may not be as high as some people think it was in the first place. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I would use the...
And the impacts are probably not as severe in women's sport to some extent.
Well, that's the big debate, right? So if we put CTE on hold for a moment, because CTE is caused by repetitive head impacts that don't necessarily cause a concussion. That's the argument that's made. Now, there's a debate again, and I'm not going to dive into the weeds like last week, where epidemiologists are split, and so are pathologists actually, around whether CTE is caused by or associated with. And that's an important epidemiological distinction that I think they make. And that's why we had this meeting in Boston to hear from two sides. And they argue sometimes quite aggressively with one another to the extent that they won't share a room. That's why we have to have one speaker then the next. We literally invited some guys who wouldn't come because they didn't want to be in the same city.
It's political.
As their opponents in this debate. So it's like many things, unfortunately polarized to the detriment maybe of discovery. But the epidemiologist debate associated with caused by, but whatever. I think if you say for a moment that it's repetitive head impacts that don't necessarily have to cause a concussion. But if we look at concussion for a moment, there is some evidence that women are more likely to suffer concussions than men. Now, that could be for a number of reasons. Now, remember, a concussion is a head impact that is severe enough to have a specific clinical outcome. It's changing something, cognitive, balance, symptoms, whatever. In rugby, it's interesting. Our data so far, and we think it's pretty good, from the women's sevens and the men's sevens, from the men's and the women's World Cups and the elite competition, is that the incidence of concussion is the same between men and women. Mm. And that's at around 15 per 1,000 hours, which equates to, for the sake of simplicity, two concussions every three matches. In two concussions among all the players every three games. And so if you took 1,000 men and 1,000 women and you made them play 1,000 matches, you would see the same number of concussed men as you would women.
Oh.
So in rugby, the rate is not different. But what's interesting is that when you look at injuries other than concussions, muscles, shoulders, broken bones, all the other nasty stuff that can happen to you, because it's not just concussion, women's risk of injury is almost half that of men's. So now men is three injuries a match, women's is at about 1.5 to 2. So overall, women are less likely to be injured. But as a proportion of injuries, women are more likely to have concussions. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
So the only accurate language I can think for this is that currently, women's and men's rugby have the same rate of concussion, which is the risk, but there may be higher susceptibility of concussion to concussion in women. So what we would be quite attentive to, and we are, World Rugby, when I say we, is as the women's game continues to evolve and they get faster and more powerful and those contacts and collisions and tackles and racks become more forceful and there's more energy in those, that concussion number may go up. And we have to be alert to that because at the moment it looks like the women's game is different enough from the men's in that it is just lower power. That's the point you were making.
Yeah.
That's not always, well, it is always going to be the case because that's the, and again,
it's physiology.
It's biology of males and females. So it's always going to be the case. But whether that gap narrows to the point that we now start to see this concussion difference, because in other sports, basketball in the US, soccer, which they call it in the US, even lacrosse, women's concussion rates are generally thought to be higher than men's. And one other thing of interest is that they happen slightly differently. So for instance, in hockey and lacrosse, women are more likely to be concussed by the equipment. Men are more likely to be concussed by another player.
Right.
And that's because I think men just play it, put the shoulder into someone, hit their head, concussion. Women maybe don't play it quite that way, but the stick and the ball and the post, etc., may be more likely to concuss them. So there are definitely more similarities than there are differences, but the differences between male and female in concussion are important enough that it's one of the most interesting areas to explore. The other, just the last point on this, one of the areas that women might be more susceptible because of is they have smaller white axons. The cells in the brain are just smaller. The necks might be weaker. The necks and shoulder muscles. So those are inherent risk factors that women have, some of which you can change. Neck strengthening maybe helps. No one has shown that for sure, but it's certainly something worth exploring. Some of them you can't. You know, you're not going to change the size of the nerves in someone's brain. So women might be more at risk of head injuries. And if that's the case, then the CTE picture may end up looking like it's worse among women than it is among men. We don't know. It's early days yet. And then the final point is, study was done in Calgary at the university, where a whole bunch of university-aged women took up rugby for the first time. Within 3 weeks of starting the sport, they're playing contact rugby. Unbelievable injury rates. Not just concussions, but all injuries. Like, just astronomically concerning. Like twice as high as you'd see in the elite game. That's a problem.
Wow.
Now, why is that happening? That's happening because they're not conditioned and technically and physically to play it. And so I think contact sports need to ask some quite serious questions about effectively asking people to qualify to play contact sport at that intensity.
And I suppose it also applies to younger athletes and sportsmen in those games as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, except that the thing I think that protects the younger athlete is that when you're staying on rugby, if you're a young kid in South Africa, England, New Zealand, where rugby's religion, okay, not England, but those other two, but you're playing it in England, you're in contact from the age of 6, 7, 8 years old. But the kid you're running into weighs what, 30-something, 40 kilograms?
Mm.
Slow speed, low forces. Mm. And so you learn the technical competencies when the risk is lower. And by the time you get to 16, 17 and the testosterone starts to do its thing, you've actually kind of acquired a base level of skill and conditioning that allows you to withstand it. I think there's a real risk where you take women and you expose them to that risk without the necessary homework.
Mm.
And so I think that there probably is mileage in saying that you shouldn't play full contact adult rugby until you've achieved at least some minimal competency. It's like, you don't let someone get behind the wheel of a car. It's dangerous.
Yeah.
I suspect contact sports should be treated the same way. You've got to learn it before you can fully do it.
Mm.
So there's a whole area about women and men that's useful to explore, and the CTE case is one of them. It's just a trigger for a handy conversation. Mm. Anyway, yeah.
I mean, the fact that you have these conferences and there is so much research going into this, we've talked a little bit about the fact that for federations and world federations, looking after athletes has become paramount for two reasons. First of all, it's their duty to make sure they're looking after the people that are playing their sport. But there's also the ramifications of potentially being sued later down the line for not taking the right precautions. If you had to look at a perfect study, are we 10 years away from reaching the right levels of conclusions around CTE, for instance? Because you talk about the fact that just finding brains and finding the research and that sort of thing is almost impossible to do that. Also, having a baseline, I mean,
at least
it's not something that's going to happen next year, is it?
At least 10 years. And the reason you need at least 10 years is because the condition's only going to appear much later. This Heather Anderson at 28 is actually an unusual case because that might be 1 or 2 years after playing.
Mm.
Most of the cases that you're seeing, and again, CTE is one of, there's also just dementia, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's.
Mm.
You know, there are studies that have related the risk of let's use the catch-all, neurodegenerative diseases to concussions, even in people who've had theirs in car accidents. But you have to track these players for a very long time because the appearance of the condition might be 20 years after the exposure to the risk events, whatever they might be. Or it might be, and again, Lancet, which is one of the most respected journals, is listed as causative or contributing factors to dementia, 12 different things. Head impact is one of 12.
Yeah.
Sleep disorders, anxiety, depression, those are all factors. Again, there are 12 there. I'll provide a link again in the show notes. So to do the study that conclusively establishes and you need a cohort that you can track for a relatively long time, you have to be able to measure that some of the people in that cohort are exposed and others are not exposed to your repeated head impacts, but also to those other 11 things potentially or more, maybe not, who knows? And then you'll get it eventually. So the point is, it's a long time.
Yeah.
Now, the sport can't wait for the research. And that's why I think the action needs to be taken in advance of the finding. And the action is assume that they are responsible and therefore do what you can to reduce them within reason. That's And when I say them,
which is why we have the new tackle laws in rugby, etc.
Exactly. So it's repeated head impacts. And in the case specifically of women, where we've got this strong evidence of increased susceptibility, reducing exposure to head impacts becomes even more important. Maybe there's a premium on it. But also think about neck strength. Think about tackle technique. Think about ball carrying technique. This, you might, listeners might pick up a paper and read about women's concussion, and you'll see something that women are more at risk of a concussion when they're falling on the ground because they hit their head on the ground. We've got data on 120-odd head injuries in the last two seasons in women, and only one in 16 injuries happens that way.
Mm.
More than in men, where it's like literally one in 50, one in 100. So yes, women are more likely to be concussed because of head ground than men are, which tells you that maybe men are just more skillful at falling, being tackled, making tackles, you know? And that is a skill. You had sons.
Yeah.
You see how boys tend to wrestle and play. And I think they're learning skills that are transferable. Girls, society, maybe aren't as exposed to that. And then they play rugby, which is awesome, but they now that technical proficiency is exposed. But I want to make the point that it's not the ground that's the most risky thing. It's the 16 out of 17 concussions that happen because of contact with an opponent. And that's what we've got to fix. So if you're a parent, you've got to minimize as much as possible repeated head impacts. Doesn't mean don't play the sport because there's many benefits. But for girls in particular, I would be looking really hard at the competency and the conditioning and asking whether they are ready for their contact environment, because that seems to me to be the risk factor.
I wonder it's just a bit of a hypothesis to some extent, but I remember talking to somebody when I was doing a little bit of surf skiing back in the day, where surf ski is obviously a sea kayak and it requires a fair amount of balance. And I always used to be amazed by the fact that women tended to be better at surf skiing and the balancing aspect of surf skiing than they were compared to the men. So men would struggle with the balance side of things. And I remember speaking to somebody who was quite a good surf skier, and she said, well, it's quite obvious. Women are bottom heavy, men are top heavy, because that's where. And I wonder if there's something in that, because there's no doubt that men carry a lot of their weight in their shoulders and the upper body because of just the muscle size, where women tend to carry their weight a little lower. And maybe the strength that men naturally have at that top level, it makes them less susceptible to impact.
There's no doubt that when you look at the male-female differences in performance, they are the smallest for things that involve leg, obviously endurance versus speed and power. But if you want to find the biggest biological differences, you look at exercise or activities involve upper body force production and power. So weightlifting, for instance, throwing events, the shoulder joint between men and women is massively different. And then punching ability, for instance, those things. Now, no one's ever assessed the ability to take a punch or a hit if you're playing a contact sport as opposed to boxing. But it stands to reason, I think, that neck musculature, shoulder strength differences would make a significant difference to my risk of my head moving excessively, rotating, snapping back, etc., in addition to my ability to anticipate. That's the skill part, and then there's a strength part. And so it's a very reasonable hypothesis that if you can introduce a strength training and a technique training course in women who are going to play contact sport, you will reduce the risk of concussions and significant head accelerations, which is probably what you want to do actually overall.
So just on a technical question, so I understand this correctly, because I'm kind of almost arguing against myself here. When there is an impact of the brain, we talk a little bit about the fact that the brain is sort of free floating inside the skull. So if you've got a strong, for instance, strong neck muscles which prevent the head from moving side to side, does that necessarily prevent the brain from moving side to side? Because essentially the action of concussion, you can't stop the brain from moving. You might be able to stop your head from moving, but an impact's still going to create whether you're weak or strong.
You can't stop it, but you can anticipate it and then dampen it.
Okay.
So think about a whiplash concussion.
Because you're stronger.
Yeah. Okay. So like a whiplash concussion, you're sitting in your car and you get rear-ended at a traffic light. And as a consequence, your seatbelt stops you from going through the front, which is really happy days, good news for you. But your head still snaps forward.
Yeah.
And that can actually cause an injury. In fact, we see around 1-2% of all rugby concussions don't have a head impact visible. So they're also probably inertial or whiplash.
Yeah.
And that's just that snap. Now imagine a fist hitting your face in a boxing bout, or a tackle, like accidentally an illegal tackle, or sometimes legal. And a similar thing would happen is, I would ask two questions, is did you have the ability to anticipate it? We know from our data that head injuries and concussions are much more likely when you're tackled from behind and when you're unsighted. Why? Because you didn't anticipate it. So you got hit without being able to brace. You know, that brace position. Mm. Think about a boxer.
What's so the brace protective? Does, yeah, the brace does have a
yeah, because role. I think it puts the shoulder and the neck into a position that most successfully or effectively stabilizes the neck and therefore the head against that snap, that fast rotation. So now instead of rotating at 7,000 radians per second squared, it's 3,000. And that it's not deceleration, but less acceleration. Less is going to be. That makes sense, right?
Yes, I'm seeing what you're saying.
Similarly,
yes.
Linearly. Yeah. Mm. There's some really interesting studies where they've attached people sitting in a lab to an elastic cord behind them that they can't see, and then they've measured the muscle activation, and then all of a sudden that elastic gives their head a jerk, and you measure the muscle's response to it. And the studies find that if you warn women, they are able to prepare for that and have a lesser acceleration than if they're unwarned, whereas in men they seem to rely more on strength. I'll put the paper in the show notes, but basically there was a biological difference in how the head responds in the sexes to sudden unexpected load. Men rely on neck strength and women rely on anticipation and pre-activation.
Mm.
And so there are definite sex differences in the game and in the way that we cope with that head, let's call it head load in quotation marks. You know, we've got, I did a paper a couple of years ago, 14,000 baselines looking at cognitive function sound in men. We had 1,000 women. So that's the scale difference between research in men and women. But in the next 3 years, we will have 8,000 women's data points. And so we're on this massively accelerating curve of understanding in women. And so it's an exciting phase, but we're starting late, as it were.
There's a lot of data to deal with there.
No, it's a lot. And I mean, truthfully, I'd rather not have it. I mean, we've got hundreds of concussions every year.
Mm.
And so in 4 or 5 years, we'll have hundreds of concussions in women to talk about. But at the moment, we have far fewer than that.
Fascinating.
So it's you know, it's like what's over the horizon. No one really knows.
Mm. Just to wrap it up, the conference you went to, is it a organization that looks particularly at concussions and head injuries, or is it just a group of people in that like-minded space?
Well, it was a specific internal World Rugby event that was put on for our concussion working group. And that's a group of independent folk from different unions who work in the clinical space, either as chief medical officers of unions, researchers, independent doctors. So they're rugby folk. And we then went to Boston because I'd say of the 9 people we heard from, 4 or 5 are based in Boston or close to Boston. Mm-hmm. So it made sense to go to the mountain, as it were. Yeah. And then the other 4 were invited from around the world. Some came in from other parts of the US, from Canada and so on. And so then we heard from the experts there. So it was a specific like fact-finding mission for World Rugby to hear directly from the experts on both sides of the debate. And again, you know, there's a debate around the existence of CTE. Pathologists would, in some areas, disagree about how you identify it. They certainly disagree about how you diagnose it in a living person. They disagree about how it's caused. And we wanted to hear from both sides, much the same way when World Rugby did its transgender policy back in 2020. That was the approach. Let's give both sides, the for and against, if there is such a thing in CTE. There definitely is in trans. A possibility to educate us, and then we discuss it, and then we take away from that actions. That's the key. I mean, we're not in a stamp collecting exercise here. We want actions that can come out of this.
For sure.
So that's what we got to do next.
It's a very fascinating subject, and I suppose we could talk about that for the entire podcast, because there is so many things that I pop into my head as you go along. But
I reckon there's a whole podcast series just on women in team sport. I mean, like, there's often discussion on women endurance athletes versus men, and maybe we'll get onto that later on when we do our Born to Run. But just even on team sports, like the women's research space is, there's a Women's Football World Cup starting now, imminently in New Zealand, and actually got a name of someone who does a bit of research in women and how their feet are different and how that has implications for injury risk and comfort of football boots that has never been catered to. So there's lots going on is the point. And yeah, we could talk for an hour. And
well, we have been talking about getting a women's specialist onto the show, which we are definitely going to do in the next couple of months, because I think it's critical that we deal with those sort of issues. And it's a fascinating area. And I think sport being very dominated, male dominated in many areas for so many years, finally we are going to see, we're seeing more in research into women's sport. Anyway, so onto that subject, the next one is an interesting one, because this is the University of Colorado, a story that appeared in Runner's World in the US, talking about the fact that they have now put guidelines in place and talking specifically around body composition. They used to do tests there. They now said that they're going to stop doing these tests because essentially it exacerbates eating disorders and causes other harms, especially athletes in the women's team. So it's kind of... In short, what it's saying is that they're saying they're not going to be testing athletes based on weight, because there are psychological reasons mainly for that. And it is therefore just doing away with that. But I guess that makes sense, isn't it? I mean, I never really understand why body composition is important when time should be the measure of performance.
I'll tell you why. To answer that bit first, I'll tell you why. It's because coaches live and die by the environment they create for their athletes. It's become, I think, to the point of a cliche, culture, environment, and so forth.
Yes.
Ted Lasso kind of vibe
is
an example of, fictional but good culture. But a lot of the time, a coach will come into an environment, irrespective of whether it's an individual or a team sport, but it's a team environment, right? And even in a running squad, track and field, cross-country runners. And they say, we're going to set up an environment that optimizes performance. And then they start looking for all the elements within that environment that they can control. So they say, we put posters on the wall and stupid things like that and cliches above the door. Yeah. But one of the other things they do is they start saying, okay, we're going to use measurement to help create culture and track progress, because that's important. And the scientist in me applauds that, because I think measurement and a systematic approach to are we improving is important.
Mm.
But then they say, what can we measure? And one of the things you can measure is body fat, body weight, body composition, muscle mass if you're in a different team environment, football, whatever it is, environment. And I think they then start over-measuring it, because there's a link in their minds in these weight-affected sports, cycling, running, swimming. Most sports are weight-affected, but some more than others. There's a link between those things and performance. And so the measurable thing starts quite quickly to become the locus of control, becomes the lever that you use to control the environment. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah.
And then you overplay it, and it becomes the preoccupation, as opposed to just one of many things that might be indicative of something that needs to change. But it should probably be quite low on that list for the reasons that you've just said there. So, and it's not, I mean, when did we spoke to Amelia Boone, like 3-4 years ago?
Yeah.
And then shortly
almost
after that.
Almost the poster girl of these issues.
Yeah, and she speaks very openly. And if you go back, I'll see if I can dig it up out of the archives and post a link. She talks openly about her own disordered eating and how the pressure to lose weight in order to run better was a contributor. Then we followed it up very shortly thereafter where we chatted to Trent Stellingworth and his wife, Hillary. He's a physiologist. She's a former elite athlete. And they shared their approach to weight management in distance runners and the science of it. That was in the context of Mary Kane coming out and accusing Salazar of bullying them into losing weight and contributing to her development of disordered eating and REDS, which is that relative energy deficiency.
That was the story that really blew this whole thing apart.
Right, exactly. So this is not uncommon to have happen. And the reason it happened now, just to go back to Colorado, is that about a year ago, an athlete came out and made accusations that they'd been subjected to this frequent body composition assessments, which created a toxic culture there. And the report then came out 2 weeks ago, in which they've now interviewed.
And to their credit, it's an independent report, which you have to give the University of Colorado credit for doing that, because they wanted to really reach the truth around this. They weren't trying to cover anything up, which I guess is a good...
Yeah, and two reports, actually, the way the article, and I'll link to it, describes it, there was an initial review and then subsequently the university asked the audit department to do a supplemental independent review, and that's the one that came out last week. There are those who will say that it's not to their credit. They'll say that it's woke, like nanny state thinking gone wild, right? Because it is a divisive issue, this. Some people say, obviously you weigh them, because if they eat badly and they're there to perform, then they're not going to perform. So there is a split among reaction to this, and I was reading some chats on some forums in the aftermath of this, and it very much is split between those who say, hey, it's a high performance environment, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen.
Yeah.
And those who then say, actually, no, this is toxic bullying culture. So just trying to sift through the two poles and find, like, there's a point in the middle where probably you want to land, right?
Yeah. I guess that you've got to be able to justify testing on the basis of the fact that it is related to performance. Yeah, but again, they're saying that this body composition testing is therefore, they're saying it doesn't relate to performance because there must be other measures because of its negatively affecting the student athletes.
Yeah, so what eventually happened is they did this investigation, this audit committee, in a few different areas. One was in how the program managed injuries, because I assume they found that a lot of athletes were breaking down with probably stress fractures and other injuries. They looked at the body composition assessments, and then they looked at the general environment and how they were managing training. And there's a few things where they concluded that there was no evidence. For instance, no evidence athletes were overtrained or subjected to harmful training practices. Those who were overtrained said they often felt pressure from teammates or themselves, not coaches and other staff, which is interesting. Investigators, I'm reading from the Runner's World article, did conclude that the use of some of 7 skin folds negatively impacted on a number of athletes. In addition, for a number of team members who participated in the inquiry, especially in the women's team, the program had an unhealthy environment and culture. They talk later about how athletes began to dread those testing days when they were going to have their skin folds measured, and they would starve themselves in the days leading up to it in order to try and get under some bar that had obviously been set for them. And that's where you start to realize that even if you can make a case to use this tool, by the time athletes are dreading themselves and starving themselves in anticipation of it, the tool has stopped being worthwhile. Like, even if it's theoretically useful, in reality, it's actually not only harmful.
And you're not doing an accurate assessment anyway.
Yeah. You're not and you're actually, so there's, you might then say, as the coach or the nutritionist who was, I gather, driving this, because there's a quote here in this article where, one of the coaches, or I think it's the nutritionist, defends themselves and says that there's a good relationship between some of 7 skin folds and performance, and that's why they wished to do it. And so they obviously feel like they're justified in doing it, and they think that there's a benefit. And I dare say they would also recognize that there's a cost, a risk. But they're plowing on ahead with it because they think the benefit's greater than the risk. But if athletes dread it and are starving themselves, then the risk has already gotten bigger than any benefit. So you should have stopped it quite a lot in advance. And I think ultimately it just comes down to a human touch that seems to get lost sometimes. Because you'd know as a parent, right? I can't relate to this element of it. But as a coach or as a parent, sometimes a kid needs a gentle shoulder and a soft word of encouragement. And sometimes they need a bit of a bollocking.
Yeah.
Right? And sometimes the same athlete needs 2 different things on 2 different days. One of your kids might have needed more of one, more and less of the other, and vice versa for the other son. And so I think good coaches probably should recognize the signs of these things not working before they happen. And so I think it's more likely a systems failure than a tool problem would be my
reaction. And I mean, in my experience, having watched many athletes, cyclists, triathletes, all those sort of things, the many different body shapes that you see in those sports that take them to the top level is so different, because sometimes you get long, lanky, lean athletes, sometimes you get short, squat athletes, sometimes they're competing in the same event at the same level, but body-wise, they're completely different. So there's, as much as you talk about the physiology of bodies being similar depending on the sport you're doing, it there are outliers. There are people who might not look like the good runners, but actually they are.
And that's why
all the other sports.
If you set targets now, and I assume that's what's done here, it's Body Composition Tuesday.
Yeah.
And we're going to measure it. And if you're not below a certain target, then you've got to make certain changes. And now you go away there with a stigma that I'm fat. You're going to eat less well. So the moment you set a target, you've got to be hell of a sure that that target's appropriate for each person.
Yeah.
Because if you're not, you're going to drive a behavior that's actually going to undermine performance. Like, would you rather have an athlete who's starving themselves to be skinny and then running slowly because they're undernourished?
Yeah, they've got reds. Yeah.
It's ridiculous. So, so in actual fact, they say, oh, it's risky if you're too heavy. If your skin folds are too high, that's an underperformance. There's as much risk of underperformance if you go too low. And so drawing that line and saying this is where you got to be is quite tricky. Mm. And the best advice I would give then to coaches is exactly what you're saying is focus on the performance. And if you manage the training inputs that make the performance and you've got a good handle that the person is at least eating well, nutrition, like in terms of the composition, the amount, and the timing of their meals and their food, then the performance is the consequence of good behaviors.
Mm.
And you don't actually have to worry about a scale.
Great.
Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's the key point there.
Yeah.
I do wonder whether there's an element of insecurity drives measurement because the coach is, remember, the coaches and this nutritionist and so on are responsible for managing the environment, training inputs, diet, and so on.
Mm.
And if you now over measure, is it because you don't trust the process well enough that you've got to constantly check? It's like baking a cake and then having to check it every 5 minutes while it's in the oven. That's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Put it in, let the ingredients do the work, and then take it out when it's ready.
Mm.
This seems to me to be a over compensation on measurement that might have its roots in a little bit of insecurity and lack of confidence in the process.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that 100%. Yeah. And then following up from that, Swim England, they've announced that they're going to ban the weighing of children at its clubs after swimmers have spoken out about suffering eating disorders and mental health issues as a result of this.
You change from land to water and you hop across the Atlantic and you have the same problem. So it's universal. Mm. And in this instance, it's children, not college athletes. So then I suspect, you know, that's I would argue more severe. I would argue that you could do it in an adult environment more easily than in a college.
Yes, they have said over 18 they're allowing it, but under 18 not. It makes sense,
right? You get young kids that are...
What I find surprising there is that is potentially happening, that there are 14, 15, 16-year-olds being weighed by coaches in a sport where weight is less significant than it is in cycling and running, for instance. I'm also confused about that. But also the fact that is so prevalent because it doesn't seem like it's something that you would necessarily measure massively in swimming.
Well, this article piqued my interest. And just thank you to Gareth Davies, who's now been anointed as our chief research officer. He sent this one to me.
Mm.
And it piqued my interest because, as you know, I'm working with Ilana in that EnduroCAD program. And we're now embarking on our Talent ID camp drive. So we've invited athletes from all around to come to 3 separate testing days. And we go out on what we call our Talent Roadshow to outlying communities where we ask young athletes to come along and test. And we've got a battery of tests. It'll be fun to talk about, actually, one day. And there's a big question among the coaches is, do we weigh them?
Okay, yeah.
So the answer is, well, no, because it's not really an element of talent ID. we're looking for performance capabilities, not body composition. Yeah. We're not offering scholarships to the skinniest people in the Cape. We're offering to the fastest runners. So,
yes.
So the answer is no. But once they're in the program, we've had an interesting tension where our sprint coach wants weights and our distance coach, who's Zola Peterser, who would be well known to listeners
of
the sport going back to the 80s, like an icon. Sometimes have to say it's bizarre that I'm
hanging out with Ilana May in South Africa, probably the biggest names in the sport.
High performance director of a training program for kids, and Zola Peterser is the coach of the kids. It's amazing, and she's a lovely, lovely person. Yeah, I really, really enjoy working with her. But she's absolutely will not weigh those kids, no matter what age they are. Just nothing. Whereas our sprint coach says, "I want to weigh them." It's okay. Why is that? And this is the difference in environments now. Is our athletes are coming from rural areas in South Africa, which many listeners may be not able to relate to, but the bigger problem for us is malnutrition.
Mm.
And so what happens is they're school kids and they're put up in a hostel for 3 months at a time, then they go back for 2-3 weeks. They're on their 1 month mid-year break now. They'll come back in much worse condition than when they left because they actually don't have enough money to eat well. And so he wants to weigh them to make sure that the muscle, I'd actually rather do lean mass testing, but we don't have the resources for it. Mm. He wants to weigh them to make sure they're not losing too much weight, which is an interesting, so that's a difference, right? And so we're saying, okay, we can do this with the understanding that it's necessary and it's going to be used sensibly to not create stigmas around it. But for the girls on the sprint squad and for the middle distance boys and girls, we have to be quite careful about, like, what do we measure and how do we create these stigmas and behaviors in young athletes too young, you know? But I'll give you an example. Is one of the, there's a high school around here and it's a fairly remote area. The guy will literally pick the athletes up and say, I can't pick you up. You've gotten too heavy. You need to lose weight. Now we laugh, but like, that's the kind of thinking, right? Like, that's not even a scale. That's like me picking you up and saying, last time I could lift you, now you must be getting heavy. Mm. Now imagine a 15-year-old girl. And so this is not good,
massive
right?
impact, yeah.
But I just want to add some perspective. Is that coach, as flawed as that particular thinking is, has been responsible for sending dozens of kids overseas to chess competitions in Japan, to table tennis events in the USA, runners he's given scholarships. He's changed more lives than like you could probably imagine, like because he drives the kids actually quite hard, but he's helping them escape a situation that they're otherwise in. But he's still doing this really dodgy thing, right? So it's sort of, I just want to make that point so that people are not always all bad and all good. And nor is the coach at
Colorado.
That's
probably more naive.
Exactly.
Rather than just dodgy.
There's, and so there's no malice in what, I don't think there's malice in what these coaches do. Not the Swim England coaches, not Wetmore, not his dietitian, not this guy in Claver who, when his overall contribution is assessed, I'm pretty confident will come out significantly in the green because he's changed a lot of lives. But I'd much rather he didn't see the athletes that we work with and tell them they've gotten too heavy because he can't pick them up, you know, because then we're going to have to pick up the pieces.
Exactly.
So it's a complicated area, and I'm sympathetic to the coaches who are trying to maybe sometimes do the right thing, but they just lack. Anyway, I think you know where I stand on it. So
yeah. Anyway, it's an interesting thing because we have talked about the development of young athletes and the psychological effects as much as the physiological effects that have make them great or not great. And you can have a look at some of our podcasts we've done on that in the past. It's always a fascinating area. Anyway, on to another sport which we don't talk about that much. And I have to confess that I haven't watched enough of the Ashes at the moment. They're, of course, England and Australia playing the Ashes series at the moment. I kind of had a cursory look at the first test and haven't watched much of the second test. But it's always very exciting because there is that needle, there's that little bit of aggro, the traditional rivals between the two of them. Of course, the Ashes taking place in England at the moment and the second test taking place, I think, at Lord's. Now, there was a bit of a study that came out, and I'm going to draw the two studies together and also some of the recent incidents that have happened. There was a study that came out by the Independent Commission for Equity in Cricket, which talked about systemic discrimination in the English game, where there has been a proof that English cricket's inbuilt prejudice against women, people of colour, and people from poor backgrounds have affected the game and people's involvement in the game. And the thought is, even though they don't say directly, is because of the sport being reasonably elitist, therefore people coming into the sport from non-elite backgrounds have been prejudiced against.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating one because when you think about cricket globally, it is a sport which doesn't seem to have elitist backgrounds. You look at all the many different countries that play it. And in England, there is, you know, variety of different players in the system. So it's controversial because obviously the overreaction is, oh, goodness me, another woke bit of research here. Is it really a problem?
Well, it seems to be so in England. And I mean, I don't want to dive into the racism.
Yeah.
So this report, followers of the sport in England might remember that Michael Vaughan was one of a handful of people. Matthew Hoggard was another. They were accused of racism for incidents that happened. I think they were with Yorkshire Crickets. And it subsequently emerged that there were a number of players. Like, they got a number of players in England of Indian or Pakistani descent who were playing there. And they were the initial, can one say, objects or victims of this particular racism and so on. Vaughan, I think, eventually was cleared. But they commissioned this independent report, and it's what came out. I mean, you covered a lot of cricket. You traveled, I guess, to India to cover cricket.
Yeah.
And when you go
it's like a religion there,
you see no barriers to playing cricket. In fact, if there's an open spot, it's a game of cricket, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite the same in England,
yeah,
where it is very much driven by the what most people would understand is the private schools, the very wealthy individuals in the private schools. It's very elitist. If you watched the second test at Lord's, you would have seen the members of the Lord's Club made the news for acting, shall we just say, in a non...
Yes, well, we're going to talk a bit about this.
Were acting in the most elitist possible way in their weird hats and red pants and ties, hurling abuse at the Australians. But it's that's the kind of... You know they're saying it's just not cricket, sort of said, peering over your reading glasses down your nose in a very patronising way. Mm. that's basically the epitome of this the reason for this report. And I don't want to, as I said, I don't want to go into it massively. There was one line in a report that grabbed my eye, and that's that the percentage of England's male cricketers who are privately educated is 58%. And only 7% of the population at large go to those private schools. So you are significantly more likely to play cricket for England if you go to one of those private schools. Now, I understand in the context of the racism and some of the systemic problems in English cricket why that's the issue. And we have the same thing here in South Africa, right? Remember, we have private schools that produce arguably even more than that proportion of our rugby and cricket players. Mm. And even... I mean, I don't think 7% of our population is in private schools. I'd be surprised if it was 1%.
And purely because private schools have the resources to get good coaches.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so when I read that, I actually see the description of quite a good sports system.
Yeah.
Like the idea that 1% of your population can make up 60% of your net, that shows a highly efficient sports system in that pipeline.
Yes. But you're potentially missing people.
Exactly. Yeah. So when viewed from outside it, the thing you want to fix is exposure to the pipeline.
Yeah.
You need more of your best resources. It's like a gold refinery.
Mm.
It's producing 60% of our gold comes from one mine. Well, that mine's really doing really well. Don't change that. Just figure out ways to get the same kind of thing elsewhere.
Mm.
Now, the upside of having almost 2/3 of your cricketers come from privately educated is that the English cricket's not paying for them.
Mm.
Someone else is covering the cost of developing 2/3 of their national team. What a beautiful situation. So yeah. They wouldn't want to change it. In the same way that SA Rugby wouldn't want to change the fact that half the Springboks at the World Cup are coming from 7 schools in South Africa. Okay, I'm making numbers up now, folks. Don't quote me on that. But because the system is basically feeding itself. Mm. Why change that system?
Mm.
But the reason you want to change that system, and the reason this article resonates with me, is because we have this debate in South Africa all the time about transformation. You know, we've got this historically disadvantaged population who just cannot bridge the gap that was created by decades worth of lack of access and exposure and opportunity, right?
Mm.
And then you get quotas where teams are forced to select a certain number of players of African and non-white ancestry. And so it's harmful. The thing is, it's necessary because at the moment, we're like a farm with 10 hectares of arable land and we're only using half a hectare.
Mm.
So there's 9.5 hectares of potential that we're not realizing. And so how does a sport figure out how to turn that unused resource into something without breaking the bank? Because the problem is that half a hectare is performing so well that it's actually quite good.
But could it perform better if there was more access?
Maybe not. Like maybe if
maybe there's a big wealth of talent that they're not accessing.
And that's the thing. You've got to decide, do you want to be deep and narrow or do you want to be broad and wide?
But the Indian system, I would suggest, is broad and wide.
It would be really interesting to know how they channel that broad and wide into their best 50-odd players. Like IPL has helped them a lot because now they've got resources to pick and expose 80 players every year to top-level cricket as opposed to what they used to do with 30. So now they've more than doubled their chance of seeing people in the shop window. But you'd want to be real careful about this if you were English Cricket Board to try and say we're going to... Because if you accept that 58% in private schools compared to only 7% of the population is a problem, what's the solution? Is it to pick more from outside the private school system? You're probably weakening your system. Is it to put more people in the private school system? They're not going to, And secondly, then you change the resource balance within that system and maybe it becomes less effective. So you've got to be quite delicate, I reckon, about fixing that problem. Now,
there's a paragraph in the story that appeared in The Guardian, which I'm just going to read because it kind of to some extent answers your question. And it says, a staggering 87% of respondents of Pakistani and Bangladeshi heritage, 82% of Indian heritage, and 75% of all black respondents reported encountering discrimination in the game. The real kicker, though, is the deficit of trust that the vast majority felt with a game that was supposed to protect them. They're feeling that cricket's authorities, the white male captains and coaches and chief executives and board chairs who hold all the power in the game, would instinctively lean towards the status quo.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite an important paragraph there, because it's not necessarily whether players come from a certain load of schools. It's the fact that there are players who feel that they are discriminated against when they're in the system, potentially, which might push them out of the system. So you immediately, you're... Even the players that are coming through from those discriminated games, they're potentially going, well, this isn't a game for me. Therefore, I'm going to go and do something else.
Yeah, even having come through far enough in the system to make it inside.
Yeah.
They're now insiders feeling outsider.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which pushes
and that's
them
a problem.
Out.
And again, that paragraph could be written for South African rugby, except change 87 respondents of Pakistani and Bangladeshi to African. And it's that South African rugby.
But South African
problems.
Rugby's done pretty well in bringing through players of colour.
If we did a survey like this, do you reckon we'd get good responses?
I'd be interested to know that. I always feel that South African rugby done a very good job.
I think they've done a much better job than some give them credit for.
Than better done than cricket in South Africa.
Yeah. If you want to make that ranking, definitely. But it would be interesting to know. And for example, one solution would be to say, like, if you want to get, in 5 years from now, greater representation of these players and you want to get more of them inside the system, figure out where your most effective pipelines are. What are those private schools and get more of these players into them?
Or figure out a way of ensuring that these players that do come through feel that there is an awareness around how these players feel. It's an awareness
around
that.
Maybe both. You've got to do both, right? Yeah. You've got to feed more to the start of the pathway, and then those that are in that pipe
feel that they can achieve.
And that's culture change. That's not happening because of any systems that you design. That's generations worth of work that has to be done, and it's very difficult. But until, you see, you'd have to sell it and say it's performance related. Like Hilton College, now I'm naming some South African schools, Hilton College, Greyblum, Uffies and Bishops have to appreciate that their success will be more likely if they go this way. Then they'll do it, you see. But as long as it's portrayed as a barrier and a grudge, and that's why the whole quote... Anyway, now we're getting onto very local South African things. But it's just interesting... It's an interesting... To make a tenuous link between this and the subject we just discussed before about weighing of athletes in these environments is the world of high-performance sport functions with some wacky rules where it's actually designed to be maximally effective, which sometimes looks discriminatory. And you have to walk a fairly narrow tightrope between saying we want sport to be inclusive and for all as opposed to high performing. And I think this is an example of that, actually. If you fix this the wrong way, you would create a different outcome, I think.
Yeah, I'll still stand by the fact that I think it's not necessarily about being exclusive. It's about focus being on inclusive. And I don't think inclusive necessarily means that you will reduce the talent pathway. I just think
depends how you do it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure.
Depends how you do it. If you do it in a way that gives more people exposure to opportunities, you drain your resources. Then it's bad.
I still think the best way of developing any sport is to create heroes within the sport. And once you do that, you create players of colour in English cricket, for instance, will bring through more players of colour as a result of them seeing players of colour performing. It's the same thing that's happening in South African sport to some extent. We've got Siya Kolisi as our national rugby captain. I think he's done a huge amount to bring that sport into the minds of people of colour in South Africa to say, yes, it's a sport that we can play. Whereas there's no matter how much development you do, that's probably the single most important bit of development you should do.
I think that's important, but gathering from this report here, like, what you need to do with that is you need to make those people who follow the Kolisi or the Mo and Ali, whoever it might be, you have to give them assurance that they are as valuable as the people they're trying to displace, right? And that means leadership also has to change at the same time as the player body does. And that often is the bigger barrier. So anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, just on the subject of cricket, there was the incident, and we just touched on it very briefly, of a Johnny Bairstow stumping, courtesy of the Australian. Now, just for those of you who haven't watched much of it, the Johnny Bairstow swipes the ball, it goes through to the keeper, the Australian wicketkeeper, Alex Carey, throws the ball back at the stumps. Bairstow's walked out of his crease, the ball hits the stumps, he's therefore stumped. He's run out.
Stumped, yeah. It was labelled as a stumping.
Now, yeah. Of course, if you see some of the footage of the members of the Australian cricket team walking through the Lords members gallery and being booed and called cheats and all sorts of things, it's a massively controversial thing. But having watched it and having covered a lot of cricket in my day, it sounds like Bairstow was doing that affair. He has been seen to do that sort of thing before. He kind of wanders out the crease. He's not really keeping. He kind of, whether they warned him, which is kind of what you would normally do. Now, normally in cricket, for instance, one of the most common dilemmas in cricket is when a bowler comes through and somebody's kind of walking out of the crease as he's about to deliver the ball. And sometimes the bowler will stop and say, if you don't walk back inside your crease, I'm going to stump you on my way through for the delivery. And there's often a warning. And I think in the situation that we saw the second Ashes test a couple of days ago, it didn't come with a warning. He was just stumped. And I still think the way that carried through the ball, it was almost like he wasn't legitimately trying to throw it. It just happened to hit the stumps. And he thought, well, we got him because he's out of his crease. And he was given out.
Well, okay, a couple of things is they showed footage at the time that it happened of in that same over, because it obviously happened on the sixth and final ball of the over. Pretty much every ball that Bairstow had allowed to go through to the keeper, he walked out.
Mm.
And based on post-match interviews, the Australians had recognised this behaviour. So they knew it was going to happen.
But did they warn him? That's the big question.
I don't know. But I don't know that
that's
you
the
to,
etiquette of it.
I don't know if you have to warn a guy about a stumping. The bowling
well,
thing,
you have to
I guess,
warn him about
different.
The fact that he's wandering out of his crease, much as you would if you're a bowler coming through.
I don't
and
think you have to do anything. That's the point, right?
Well,
it's just this is the spirit of cricket thing now.
It's etiquette, yeah.
The interesting thing about this one is that there's photographs of Carey releasing the ball while Bairstow's still in the pit, in the crease. So it's not as though Carey waited for Bairstow to drift out and then throw it. They actually threw it in anticipation of him leaving the crease because they'd recognized the pattern, which is actually in some ways quite brilliant. They got the sixth ball. They said, he's going to, if it goes through, throw it.
Yeah.
And let's see if he drifts.
And if you hit the stumps.
And so there've been some tweets going around where wicket keepers have done this, but it's often because the player leaves the ground and then the keeper says, oh, he's out of his ground, let me go for this. This was a bit different to that because there is literally a photograph where the ball has left Carey's glove and is airborne en route to its destination. Missile has been launched and Bairstow is still in his ground, about to leave it.
Mm.
So this is an anticipatory stumping.
Yes.
Which I still don't think is a problem.
No.
Because it happens quite often.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a dispute that goes back hundreds of years between Australia and England and isn't merely the latest in a long line of arguments between them and cheat allegations. The Aussies, of course, have a reputation going back to here in Cape Town, actually. Remember with Steve Smith and the
Aussies.
Sandpaper in the pocket of match fixing and so on. But it's not unique to them.
No.
Remember, England have had it.
Wasn't, South Africans have had it a couple of times.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of like, by any means necessary, Stuart Broad was batting at the time. Well, he came out to replace Bairstow. So he was batting at the time of all the fallout. And he was telling the Aussies, you know, this is the worst thing I've ever seen on a cricket field. And he likes a win at all costs. Of course, there's quotes from Stuart Broad in 2013 saying, we're a win at all costs team and no one likes playing at us. And that's how we like it. So it's revealed, I think, my only contribution to this is it's revealed a great deal of hypocrisy. Because people will say, no, that's just not cricket, having done pretty much the same thing at
which
some
is
point
which is why the etiquette of the game is important, even at the professional level. And I'll stand by this, that if Bairstow was given warning that if you continue to do what you're doing, we're going to attempt to run you out or stump you.
So
if they didn't warn him, then I still think that is bad etiquette on the Australian team, to
be
honest.
I got my Aussie hat on.
That's my view.
Put my Aussie hat on. I won't kill you guys with my Aussie accent. My Aussie hat saying to you, why must you warn a guy to obey the rules of the game?
For the same reason why players who wander out of the crease as the bowler is coming to deliver the ball. Often it is done not deliberately. It's just often the bowler will stop and say, if you do that again, I'm going to run you out. It's been done a lot of times in cricket, and it is an etiquette of the game. And in that situation, it is a very similar situation, in my belief.
Yeah, they don't always warn though, right? Disputed.
They don't always warn, but it is seen as bad form if you don't warn. And I think the same applies here. If he was not warned, and I don't know whether we've known that. Have the Australians said that they warned him? I've seen nothing about that.
I don't think so.
And again, I still maintain that it's not a fair... It's not in the spirit of the game, and it didn't legitimately get him out. He made a mistake. Anyway, I suppose that makes it controversial.
I think being run out when you're at the non-strikers and not attempting a run is by scale worse than being stumped when you drift out of your crease absent-mindedly when you're actually facing the ball, having just faced the ball. So the Mankad feels to me like a worse act of unspirited cricket. The Mankad being when you run the gout like that. That feels worse than this. And so I could see that you'd want to warn him there. I don't. My feeling is you don't need to warn him here.
If you had to take a look at a different scenario, if Carey had thrown the ball and he throws it underarm, the chances are of him hitting the stumps were obviously not 100%. So he actually threw it, and I think he got lucky by the stumping in itself, as you know, because you've already described how he was already in the crease when he threw the ball. If he'd done that and the ball had gone through, that in itself was a warning. So if he'd missed the stumps and Bairstow had continued to do that, by that very action, he was therefore being warned not to do that.
And Pat Cummins, the Australian captain, said in the post-match press conference, where obviously this was all anyone was talking about, he said that we'd noticed Bairstow doing this, not just in this innings, but in matches before.
Yeah, for sure.
And that Bairstow had attempted it on some of them. They may well have chucked the ball at the stumps a couple of times before that for Bairstow. I don't know. But anyway, just the point on Carey launching the ball. I don't think he was just like, let me fling this and see if it's lucky. I think they knew with a fair degree of confidence that Bairstow was about to walk out and threw it before he walked.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not like they just flung it out there hoping for a bit of luck. They actually anticipated.
They knew and he was doing
planned
it.
Planned it. Yeah.
Yeah. As I say, if they'd missed, then Bairstow would have said, oh, hang on, I've got to be careful.
That might have happened. You can let us know. Anyway, there's no science to this particular one. This is all cheating.
I love these sort of discussions. They're fantastic anyway. But yeah, if you're watching the Ashes and you're into cricket, so let us know what you think about that. All you have to do is literally go onto Google and look at Bairstow stumping, and there is literally videos and analysis from anybody that's got an opinion about cricket, and they will tell you what they think about that particular incident. So they're very interesting. And then a couple of last things before we get on to our main subject, and we are going to get on to our main subject soon, I promise. This is the story around the All Sports Enhanced Games, and this is a story that is, I've had lots of people messaging me about this and asking me about it. It's basically this Australian Erin D'Souza who wants to stage the first event next year, and it's all about having an event where all the sports people can be doped and do whatever they want to do to perform, and therefore he's going to say, like, it's literally the doping games. We've discussed this off air, saying that to some extent it is just, where do you draw the line? How do you measure what drugs they can take? And it's almost preposterous that it would even happen. Well, I don't think it will ever happen, but there is certainly enough publicity to suggest that it is going to happen in some shape or form.
The way they were describing it, there'd be no lines. So that's part of the selling proposition is do what you want. We don't care. Just run fast, throw far and jump
high. And it's
high.
Called the Enhanced Games.
Yeah, exactly. And like their website's got Hall of Shame with the IOC president's face on it. It's got Enhanced World Records. It's got the event plan. It's got a tab here called Science is Real, which is funny. I didn't think that was disputed, but I haven't really gone into this in massive detail yet. Got an email from a journalist wanting to discuss the feasibility of it, saying that the financial feasibility is probably the biggest reason it won't happen, because no one would
support it. Yeah.
Which I suspect
is the case.
People
might watch it purely because it's a bit like those travelling shows back in the 1800s where you had the sort of Elephant Man and that sort of situation, because there's a fascination, I imagine, watching athletes that are clearly doped and what can they do. But you're never going to get the top guys performing and in that event because they're not going to be there. So you're probably going to get subpar performances based on elite athletes that are in standard games, Olympic Games, World Championships.
Yeah, so the Enhanced Games advocates for bodily autonomy. We embrace the inclusion of science in sports, and we fundamentally believe the choice to use enhancements is a personal one, which is true. It's just that having choice doesn't mean having no consequence, right? Athletes will not be tested for performance enhancements, and we're under no obligation to declare their enhanced status in order to compete. That's their, that's in a paragraph, their plan, and then they talk about the science is real. The illustrious history of performance enhancements, talking about the Greeks in 776 BC using performance enhancements, Roman gladiators using stimulants in 100 AD, Norse Vikings. So you can read all this stuff. Some of it's been entertaining, but I think fundamentally it's, and also actually the negative reaction to it kind of reassures me a little bit. Because that's kind of what makes me think it'll never get off the ground. You talk about there being an appetite. I can't see sponsors backing it.
Well, let's say it was streaming and you had to pay to watch. Would you watch?
No.
You wouldn't? Just from a fascination perspective.
But look at the results. I'd be tempted, if some bloke runs a 9.300 meter, I might say, I'm going to find that now and see what that looked like.
What does he look like?
Yeah, so that's a curiosity. And for sure,
and what did he take?
You know, like in a parallel universe devoid of any ethics, the concept of having a parallel track of, well, not track, stream of very similar, identical, in fact, events, and then comparing the able body to the enhanced to the non-enhanced would have certain scientific interest to it, right? Because we always wonder what's the extent of doping in the current Olympic Games, and we already think it's not zero.
No.
In fact, it might be quite a lot higher than zero. So imagine the Enhanced Games happened and they can't go faster than the current athletes. What would that mean? Well
they won't, because they're not going to get
could mean
the very
just
best
not good athletes, right?
They're just not good athletes.
Over time, would they be able to draw them? If it was financially feasible, maybe they would, right? The athlete might. But the biggest problem, I think, still on this is the moral, ethical, legal one. Because who's openly going to prescribe the... But like from the medical scene, they're either going to drive a black market in these drugs, or they're going to be asking a number of doctors to quite traceably, I wouldn't say publicly, but prescribe drugs for off-label use, knowing the risk of harm. And the litigation around that, not to mention the ethics of it, I mean, that's even lower. But even the litigation of that, I cannot see doctors backing. So this has to happen almost without the medical fraternity's consent. Can you imagine a doctor being comfortable with saying...
I was at the Enhanced Games.
It's not possible. No. So there'd be no medical support for this. So it almost entirely would have to be run on the black market. And then it won't have sponsorship.
Yeah.
And then it can't exist.
Yeah.
So I can't... Anyway, I can't see it happening. I'm sure it'll throw up in the course of the next few years, well, whether it's even got the legs to go that far, I don't know. But some more interesting discussions around this, because, I don't think there's a large enough pool of good athletes who want to go. There's almost no pool of doctors who would stand behind it. And you can't have the event without them. Even if it's legal, you need doctors, never mind illegal. And then, you can't even get cigarettes and alcohol companies to put sponsorship on shirts and events now. How's a doping games going to get any... not happening.
Yeah, so, I mean, the only paragraph that interested me about this that I think is a feasible, and you'll love this from a science perspective, is in the story, and again, we'll put this link up, where D'Souza talks about the curiosity around a limit to human endeavors. He says it's not just a question of whether we can break 9 seconds in the 100 meters. I'm sure that we will. I don't think you will, just by the by. I want to see our 40, 50, 60-year-olds break world records, because performance medicine is the rod to anti-aging. So he's talking about the fact that all these medications...
He's not wrong there.
And he's not wrong there. So we all know that, for instance, in males, as you get older, your testosterone levels go down. Yeah. I know people that I know personally who take testosterone because they're 50-plus and they want to gain more muscle.
Growth hormones, same thing.
Growth hormones, exactly. So it's one of those occasions where there are drugs that are, as he is quoted as saying, FDA approved. They are there to limit and to slow down the aging process. Maybe these games show that these these drugs are capable of doing that. So there might be some evidence and some reason why some of these drug companies might say, well, we've got a 50-year-old who's run a sub-10 second 100 meters because he takes testosterone.
Yeah. The problem is, bang. The problem is that even if they did that, that they would have to go in there with certain constraints on how much is used, because the recipient of that at the enhanced games is not the 50-year-old, because I'm definitely not tuning in to watch a 50-year-old go on 10.4. Like, that's boring.
But you might see athletes who are older participating, because he's certainly pushing that in the press releases.
But the 50-year-old bloke who runs 10.4 is not interesting. It's a 26-year-old who runs 9.3 that would be interesting to those with a morbid curiosity, I think. I think there's to watch, right?
To watch, yeah.
And the prestige is on that guy also. So that guy saying, I want to take 30 milligrams a day. And the drug company says, but we recommend 2. Mm. And he says, but 30 will help me run 9.2. And they say no. And suddenly it's no longer feasible. You know what I mean? Like, so, there's an argument, I think, to be made that current anti-doping puts a brake on rampant doping. It doesn't eradicate it. It just constrains it. And that's probably one of the things that's helped keep a lot of athletes alive. Especially not now. I think now is a little bit better. But remember, cycling introduced its hematocrit limit because it recognized that this stuff was getting out of hand when guys were using EPO like it was orange juice.
Turning their blood into syrup.
Exactly. So you put in place regulations for the safety of athletes. This guy's proposing removing that regulation entirely. And then I just cannot see anyone standing behind it. Because, it would be interesting, but I don't think you need the enhanced games to test how testosterone and growth hormone impact aging. You can actually do that in research.
I still think it would be, I mean, it's completely hypothetical. And let's assume somebody like Usain Bolt is
in
clean.
In his prime.
In his prime. Mm-hmm. Or even if he took it now and said, right, I'm 2 years past my prime. I'm now going to go into a doping program for the next 18 months ahead of these enhanced games. And I'm going to see what time I can run. Physiologically, we know he is capable of running a world record. Maybe he's past his prime now. But with the drugs, 5 years later, is he capable of running faster? That would be, for me, a fascinating example of how literally somebody who is the very best, how drugs have actually helped that person maintain or better their past performances. You know, it's completely unfeasible, and obviously very ethically, you don't want to see that, but that's where it becomes fascinating.
I mean, what's going to happen to women who compete in the enhanced games?
Yeah, I mean, health is going
to
suffer.
But do I need enhanced games to know that?
Yeah.
No, so not really. The only reason to do it is because I want to be a kid with silkworms in a jar and be like, oh, this is that to me is nowhere near justifying. I know we agree, but can you imagine this?
It's a freak show.
That's what it stands to become if it were to happen. Yeah. And I think the fear of that happening is what will constrain it from happening, which I think is actually good for
I'd love to know if there are any television networks that are going to want to film this or broadcast it.
One thing you would say, and this is the point that journalists made, is people say, oh, the athletes who go over are cheats. Well, no, they wouldn't be, right? Because there'd be no rule. So they'd be moving from a world where it is cheating to a world where it's not. They're no longer cheats. They're actually they're just in a different context.
Mm. It's a bit like the Jim Carrey movie. What's he when he's in another world?
The Truman Show of sports.
Yeah. There's another world people live in. Yeah.
Speaking of cheating, the last one that caught my eye this week, and this is one that didn't come for a change from Gareth on Patreon. Thanks for all your work, Gareth. Really cool to get all your emails. Sarah Bark is a journalist who I've known for many years, and she started covering women's rights in sport in context of the trans issue. You're going to love this one. Mm-hmm. She now runs a newsletter called The Female Category. It's a Substack. So have a look for it. The Female Category, all one word, The Female Category. She's been on the on the trail of a non-binary runner. See, I told you you were going to enjoy this one.
My ears are pricked up.
Called Cal Calamia, who was second in the non-binary category at last year's Chicago Marathon and this year's Boston Marathon. And Cal Calamia posted a TikTok video boasting about her use of testosterone, because Cal Calamia is a female who identifies as a man and is using testosterone.
Right.
Enters the non-binary category as using a banned drug.
Yeah.
With presumably no TUE. So Sarah Barker messages USADA.
TUE being a therapeutic use exemption,
which is almost never given. Mm. Especially to women. To men sometimes,
For testosterone.
Yes, exactly. So she mails US anti-doping, and I wanted to read this to you. Simple question. Can female people who enter the non-binary category receive a TUE for testosterone? USADA's response. We understand that female athletes are not eligible for the non-binary category.
Yes.
This is the agency responsible for anti-doping. Starting an argument from the point that female people don't compete in the non-binary category. Well, then what are they?
Mm.
Non-binary. Okay, but what's sex? Non-binary. That's not a sex. That's an identity.
Mm.
You see the problem here? It's actually comical.
Mm.
So this non-binary category, which is one of the stupidest things in the first place, it's like having a category for blonde-haired, non-English speakers born in a month ending in Y. I can hear
the hate mail coming through as you said that.
No, but it's ridiculous. Like, yeah, and you know this, right? Back me up here.
Mm.
It's like having a category for blonde-haired people who don't speak English as a first language, yeah, who were born in a month ending in Y. It's like that's what it means, yes, in sport.
But don't forget, we're seeing it at major marathons. They've got non-binary, exactly, categories now.
And that's why Sarah Bark
can win prize money.
That's why, yeah, Sarah Bark is on this. Because it's like $5,000 prize money here. You're being won by someone who's, like, let's be honest, doping.
Mm.
As a female on testosterone, okay, running against males. That's the only thing that kind of equalizes this out. But the idea that an anti-doping agency can start an argument saying that female athletes are not eligible for non-binary. The non-binary category is made up of male and female athletes. The fact that they're non-binary is irrelevant. It's completely different to their sex. And so how... it's a comical, man.
Mm.
Honestly. This is not some magazine. This is the US anti-doping.
Mm.
Oh, female people. There's no females in non-binary sports.
Mm. Mm.
Later on, she says, can males running in non-binary or male categories receive a TUE? Here again, it is our understanding that cisgender males are not eligible for the non-binary category.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. Anyways, for more comedy,
it is go a comedy.
Find Sarah Barker's email.
Exactly. Now I'll have a look at that. So I'm going to make a call here because we're going to have to put on this podcast that we were going to do around running and put it over to our next edition, purely because we've been talking about such fascinating news items that we've kind of just run out of time today. So I think we're going to do that for our next podcast. And if you're listening to this, we won't have mentioned that as one of our subjects in the podcast because obviously we are doing it. But when you listen to the start of this podcast, we're talking about doing a Born to Run around running and why we're adapted to running. So we've run out of time today, but we'll definitely do it in the next episode, we promise. And we will try and reduce the amount of news stuff we've had because it has been some amazing stuff happening in the world of science, sports science at the moment. And every time we, thanks to the Patreon members, we are getting so much stuff to talk about each week.
They're legit. Five cool sports stories every week that have a sports science angle.
Yeah.
And Patreon makes sure that I miss none of them, which is amazing. I mean, there's more than five. Like, there's eight, and I can't cover three of them every week. It's wonderful. So thanks again to all our patrons. If you do like what we do and you want to support, then that's where you go, patreon.com, the Science of Sport podcast, and you can make a small pledge, a cup of coffee a month, basically.
Yep.
And you get newsletters and additional content. So
that's amazing. And also the discussions on there are absolutely fascinating from people who are absolutely like in this space like we are. And so fascinating. Yep. So Professor Ross Tucker, thanks again for your contribution. And we look forward to getting you next week when we talk a little bit about why we are adapted perfectly for running. But for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.